Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kendall Roden, Cynthia Krang, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, Russell Young, and Sajid DeMello discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please visit our website at azpodcast.com.
Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 258, being recorded on the 11th of December, 2018, with special guests, Blackie Evanson, Tommy Fargo, and Daniel Selman. And we're here on a special edition of the podcast, live from KubeCon in Seattle, where we're seeing a lot of companies besides Microsoft here, of course. Would you say we're the little fish, or how would you, what's our status in the overall?
You know, we're definitely a big fish, and we're here to help, you know, the community grow and figure out what Kubernetes is and make Azure a great place to run Kubernetes. So we're here showing up for the community, answering questions.
And that was lucky, by the way. Sorry. Go ahead, Tommy.
You could say that we're a big fish, but we're not the whale of the container.
Yeah.
And I didn't give you guys a chance to introduce yourself. So, Lucky, go ahead and get started.
Yes, my name's Lucky. I'm a PM on what we call the Cloud Native Compute team. And I specifically look after the upstream components in the open source ecosystem of around Cloud Native. So projects like Kubernetes, Mobi, Draft, Helm, Brigade. We have a team to oversee all those upstream commitments and help folks get a lot out of the tooling that we provide in this ecosystem on our cloud.
Awesome. And Tommy.
Cool. My name is Tommy Faugu. I am a cloud solution architect, and I am in the field. I work specifically with our partners. So those are ISVs, independent software vendors, or SIs, or system integrators. And I help them take their workloads and apply them into Azure and get them acclimated to the Azure ecosystem and, you know, give them a big old hug as they come in.
Nice. And we've had Daniel on the show before, but Daniel, go ahead and reintroduce yourself.
Hey, yeah. My name's Daniel Selman. I'm a Kubernetes consultant with Microsoft Consulting Services, MCS. And I mostly work with large enterprises on both building Kubernetes POCs, migrating production workloads, delivering workshops, and things of that nature. So more of the boots on the ground in terms of implementing larger scale designs.
Okay, excellent. So I know I was at the Microsoft booth just now, Lucky, and I saw you were very busy, and it was incredibly crowded, the booth. What are you hearing from our from people out there? Like, what are the things that they want to know about our offerings?
Well, you know, I'm hearing with services like AKS, the Azure Kubernetes Service, that folks are looking to invest and have a managed platform in Kubernetes. So, you know, there's maturity in the community. I've been here, I think this is my fifth or sixth KubeCon. So I've been here over the years. But now it's turning around from how do we build clusters to how do we actually run workloads and solve business problems on clusters. And that's including, I'm seeing a lot of more enterprise-y questions these days about compliance. How do I make sure that, you know, a developer, if they do push to a cluster, that they are doing it in a compliant way. So actually answering some of those questions, and we actually released an open source project today called the Policy Controller that tries to actually give folks a way to define policy around that. But we could talk about that. But I think the growth is around now these larger companies have seen the movement and the transformation around cloud native. How can they buy in to actually transform these larger, you know, more slower moving, more cautious, I'd say, but they have a lot of compliance and potentially regulation. But now how do they answer the same question that we've seen? The smaller companies come and reap the benefits from these kind of communities, being agile and nimble and not bound to these large incumbent software platforms. But we're seeing the enterprise kind of step up now and saying, how do you answer these questions for us too?
Yeah. And go ahead. Do you want to say something, Daniel?
Yeah. So that's something that I think is remarkable in terms of the large scale enterprise adoption of Kubernetes, especially when it comes to Azure. We deliver an internal container bootcamp where we have a slide showing all these enterprises that leverage Kubernetes that we use in our daily lives. And every time we redeliver it, maybe a month or 2 months later, it's doubled in size in terms of the companies. It's just a really accelerating growth kind of.
Yep. Yes. Now, Tommy, what are you seeing? You know, your CSA. So what kind of customers are adopting AKS or Kubernetes? Are they like in the retail space or this specific industry that they're in?
So, in my space, I'm seeing it all over. Okay. We've got education, we've got retail, we've got media, we've got financial services. Mm. So, with our group, it's all over the board. And that's it. They're finding more security is kind of one of those things that keeps coming out. Mm-hmm. Going back to like, what are we hearing? What are we seeing? Security. And I felt last year's KubeCon was the year of the service mesh. And this year feels like the year of like almost federation and security.
Mm. Yes, that's still an open question, right? I know, Lucky, we've probably spoken in the past. Our customer that you helped us with has asked for that feature. Do you have any insight into that? Where are we at with?
Yeah. Federation, it's a broad term that means different things to everybody in the community. So, for example, some people asking for workload portability. Some people are asking for kind of red-green, where they can fail over services from one region, or maybe even just having a global presence in region so that they can have it. And then for some people, it's just a single pane of glass. Can I have an API of APIs to control all my Kubernetes cluster? So what you're seeing with the interest around federation, I think that maturity and clusters are getting larger. There's more of them. People are carving up their workloads. So people are looking for a consolidation point. I think in the open source community, there's been a revived effort around federation, but it's mainly around Kubernetes resources and how do we make them available in multiple clusters. So there's the single pane of glass, I have an API to rule them all, and there's also if I define two services in each place, and I have one in Asia and one in the US, can there be a single entry point for both those services and have them fanned out? So I think the call to action for me in federation is if you have these use cases, please bring them to us, bring them to the community, because I think federation will only be driven by valid customer and user use cases out in the field. So if that's of interest to you, we are listening and the community is listening too. So that's what I would ask.
Yeah, I like to say that Kubernetes clusters are like Lay's potato chips. Once you pop, you just can't stop. And you never stop at just one. So how you start managing that.
Right. I mean, you know, obviously Kubernetes was born out of the trying to make some kind of sense out of the madness with having a lot of containers. And now you have the problem of having too many Kubernetes clusters.
Too many clusters,
so
yes.
Like layers upon layers, you know. Now I'm interested about the policy
controller
that you guys, can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, so it was born out of the need of how do we answer compliance? So obviously in Kubernetes, there's runtime and execution environment security constraints that you can put in, like pod security policies and security contexts, which basically means you define them and at runtime, the operating system actually makes sure that they're enforced. What we were looking for is how do we actually move the needle back to kind of create time? So how do I say before I've actually created that new object, let's call the object a deployment, my company may have some policy, right? I may need things to be labeled a certain way. They might be using only a specific container repository. They might need to have these ports open, so on and so forth. We wanted to create a way where policy administrators could create generic policies and have them either audited, validated, or mutated. So we introduced this open source project. It runs on any Kubernetes cluster, and it integrates well into another project in the CNCF space called the Open Policy Agent. So you can take a look. We released a blog on that. We'll put the links in this podcast. But you can spin it up yourself and then define some policy and then react on that policy. So what you could say, are all my services in compliance, yes or no? Which ones are out? Or you could say, at create time, I will change them to be compliant, or if somebody creates them, you could say, no, this is not compliant. So they're kind of the three operational modes to meet that. How do I get a handle on is everything that's defined in Kubernetes? And are all those things that are declarative, the declarations I actually want on our resources? So that's what we kind of set out to achieve with the Kubernetes policy controller. So.
And this is great because lots of times we'll see the security teams come in and say, we have these standards, we need this applied. But we really don't want to know that much about Kubernetes because it's the learning curve is pretty steep.
Right.
So to be able to apply this provides that nice abstraction layer again.
And of course, if you're going to go with AKS or any managed Kubernetes, it has to be done that way, right?
Right.
We don't want them mucking around with the dropping config files on the nodes or whatever.
I think it's twofold. A lot of folks use Kubernetes as the front door to their platform. So folks are, you know, development teams may have access using kubectl to the cluster. And with appropriate RBAC, that may be okay. Mm-hmm. But still, there's not a lightweight way until some of the later versions of Kubernetes to actually say, before I commit this resource to etcd, am I okay with it server-side? So all the tooling was built client-side to say, you know, I might have generators and things like that. Now you have the server-side component. And we see that pattern, you know, in things like Istio as well, mm-hmm. where you have server-side injection of policy or server-side injection of kind of observability features or traceability as well. So it's nice to not have to change a Kubernetes cluster, install a piece of software like the policy controller, reconfigure, just tell Kubernetes to validate these things without having to recompile, redeploy. Right. It's kind of a runtime configurable. So that's a really nice feature for people to, even if they have clusters, lay this on today. They don't have to start from there and then put workloads on.
Yep. Now, I was pretty amazed at the number of vendors out here who were over there at the conference floor.
Elbow to elbow and trying to get through.
I mean, not only was it packed with people, but it was packed with vendors. See, the vendors are literally, you know, shoulder to shoulder. There's so many they had to pack in there. You've been to many KubeCons before. I know, Tommy, you have been. Like, what's the trajectory in terms of the the vendor and community support for Kubernetes that you guys are seeing?
Oh, no, actually, I'm going to let you take that
one. Yeah, let me take this one.
I'm thinking about it because it's growing each time, and it's the Microsoft booth is getting more and more attention and more, like, people are really interested. Like, wow, I'm hearing what you're doing. I'm seeing what you're doing.
Right.
Oh, yeah, come by the booth. Yeah. And the demos are getting more and more.
But how about the vendors? Like, I'm seeing the number of vendors that are
has skyrocketed.
That.
Yeah. I would say, you know, this signals to me personally and watching it over the years is if you also look at the type of vendors, right, it's workload services or tools or projects that help folks understand workloads once they're running on Kubernetes. Obviously, there are this existing software vendors who have migrated their tooling to either run on Kubernetes or support Kubernetes, which is great. But I think when you think about Kubernetes, you're really thinking about this monolith, the microservices thing too, which is a complete architectural change. And in doing so, we've needed a whole new ecosystem of tooling around actually managing that. And as we, you know, get more to these enterprises, they have larger needs in terms of how do we deal with this microservices world and rationalize it. When we flattened out our application from heap and stack memory now onto network and RPCs, how do we rationalize that we meeting our SLAs? So there's, it's great to see a rich ecosystem of tooling out there for everyone. Can I do, you know, I want to do observability, I want to do monitoring, I want to do backup, I want to, you know, make it portable. So there's a tool out there for everyone. So, you know, having all these vendors kind of signals to me that there is a need and people are actually looking more at applications, because I'm also seeing less about boutique Kubernetes installers, companies based on that.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of consolidation in that area, and now workload tools.
Mm-hmm.
Managing, getting workloads on and managing workloads after they're on over time. So workload lifecycle and observability and telemetry and things like that. So
yeah. And actually, now that you've said that, okay, you're absolutely right with the tooling, because it's there are all these companies that are saying, hey, check out my tool, I've done this, I've done that. And for me, that kind of points to the ecosystem.
Yep.
Because before, it was just trying to at other conferences, it might be trying to promote themselves. Hey, come check us out. We're doing this in the field. But now it's like, hey, we want to play in the ecosystem. We want to be part of it. And they're like, so many of the booths are really them contributing and them trying to, again, maybe promote themselves, like an enlightened self-interest of, here's the tool and here's how we can give back. Yep. And I think that's very empowering and very cool to see.
Yeah. Something that kind of I've seen from afar over the last year has also been growth of the community in a non-technical way as well, mm-hmm. in the sense of the branding going on around Kubernetes. So something that I hadn't seen recently, I believe is more recent, is all the different mascots of Kubernetes, the different animals in like a Noah's Ark kind of way.
We got a few selfies.
Which I love because it provides such a like. Kubernetes as a technology is very daunting, and with non-technical friends, like explaining what it is like, hold your horses, people. And so that serving as such like a friendly face, I think, allows for more people to gain interest in this technology. Typically, you don't see that type of branding at other types of conferences in terms of just a friendly face rather than some sort of cool steampunk logo or something like that. And also just like how innovative everyone is. So with the Microsoft booth, something that I just love is the Magic Kate's balls, which if you're not familiar with it, it is an 8-ball branded with Kubernetes that when you shake it, provides you common troubleshooting tips. All these plushies that are being handed out as well that are consistent with the identity of like how they're building the non-technical brand mm-hmm. of this technology, which is something right. that is very unique.
What do you think with the growth of Kubernetes as it is right now, will the community, and Kubernetes, let's not forget, it's an open source community community project. You think the community will be able to keep up with this demand of requests? And yeah. I don't know how many pull requests are pending and whatnot.
Right.
But is that going to be reach some sort of a critical point where they say, hey, you know, we got to do something about this?
Yeah, I think one of the things I would answer that with, one of the things Kubernetes actually did really early on was make it extensible. And worked on extensibility as a first class citizen. And I know there were some lightning talks, I think Tim Hocken did one about CRDs last night, and that's really what I'm talking about here. So custom resource definitions have provided a way that tooling and vendors and ISVs can kind of come in and extend Kubernetes to enable a piece of functionality that is not actually in the core of the project, right? And can move at a different cadence and have different ownership. So the core Kubernetes identity there is fleshed out. You know, they're adding incremental changes there, but they're enabling this ecosystem of tooling to exist without it actually being in the core code base, which is enabling them to scale out of band, right? So enabling, and I've heard things such as everything will become CRDs, even the core resources will become CRDs themselves, and this will be the way that Kubernetes will be henceforth. So I think doing that enabled Kubernetes to say, here's a boundary in terms of this is the code that we maintain as the core project, but we've enabled a rich ecosystem by creating extension points that are scalable and useful to everyone. So that means, you know, I can come along and create an operator, create some custom resources that are for my particular tooling or tooling needs, and that doesn't affect what Tommy's doing over with his tooling. So, and it's all still Kubernetes native, and it can be run on multiple Kubernetes platforms. So I think in going the route of making extensibility of Kubernetes where the code does not have to land in core, mm-hmm. they've done themselves a favor by not getting a backlog of PRs going forward, because all these things now land out of tree. You know, even the cloud providers themselves, like Azure, the work is being done to move that code out of the Kubernetes repository. So Azure can take care of our cloud provider because we know our cloud best and we can move at a different cadence to Kubernetes. And by doing that, we actually relieve that pressure and burden on Kubernetes itself. So I think it's going to, they've made their life a lot easier by doing this. So.
Right. And I don't know if this is what you were implying, but something I heard in what you were saying is like, as this grows, how do we make sure it doesn't implode on itself socially?
That too.
How do we prevent this ecosystem from like hitting and fighting?
Yeah, it could get to a point where it's so confusing that nobody really knows, because there's so many different people that are working on mm-hmm. this from different mm-hmm. companies, different communities, right? And I don't think there's like one set of people, like a board of directors kind of thing that set the standard. It's a distributed thing. And that's what you're talking about.
Yes,
right?
And yeah. I think that it's funny. Like, I think that Kubernetes has taken the pod itself into like a social aspect of these special interest groups, the SIGs. And I'm not on a SIG, but it seems to me as if the SIGs are very are almost designed like as a distributed system. Mm-hmm. They're able to be able to act independently. They have really good abstraction layers, and they're able to communicate across them. And I think that's one thing that early on, whoever it was that did that was brilliant in making sure that that's how the groups were organized and distributed. And I think that's going to help the ecosystem expand past itself, so it's greater than the sum of its parts.
One thing that I think really helps too is that with ever-expanding Kubernetes tooling and potentials to plug in this or that as particular options, that's where managed Kubernetes, I think, begins to really thrive, and it allows for continual strengthening of certain standards. So with such a pool of different types of projects, being able to identify what really, from a cloud provider perspective, provides the best functionality and best support from a management plane perspective to customers.
We have to play nice together.
Yeah. So,
yes.
Now, I know we talked about managed and unmanaged Kubernetes. Obviously, the managed Kubernetes is where we want customers to go to. But do you see in the future, do you see the work being more focused on just managed, on the managed kind of version of Kubernetes, or is it always going to be in the upstream version, and then that's somehow going to make its way? Like, how does that,
I can speak, authoritatively on AKS, and we've made a commitment that we're always going to run upstream Kubernetes.
Okay.
Right, so the flow is still from the community up. And our team and our engineering team is always landing features in the upstream to actually downstream them back into AKS, right? So even though we can offer a fantastic service and remove a lot of operational burden, we still don't want to impart any restrictions to what the upstream community is actually doing. So in doing so, we're drinking from the fire hose because things are moving at an extreme pace. But we're also signaling that, we can ingest these and actually give you a reasonable service experience out of this with services like AKS. But I think, there will always be a world of customers that want to tinker with every aspect of Kubernetes. It's certainly very configurable. And we still have ACS Engine out there as well. So if you want to roll your own cluster on Azure, we can provide you the tooling to actually do that if you have specific workload use cases where AKS does not meet your criteria. But with AKS itself, we optimize for supportability and stability rather than having every feature enabled, right? We want you to have a great experience with stable platform. We think that's more important. We think we can give you that with a managed service. And obviously, updates. We've just gone through a CVE last week where we had everybody patched. once published, it was publicly disclosed, we'd had everybody already patched, right? So with you can reap the benefits of, there is a CVE, there is a zero day for us in the Kubernetes community. What does this mean for us? And rest assured, with AKS, we're taking steps to actually make sure you're patched and not vulnerable to these things as they come up in the community.
Right. I believe they were able to patch all the servers.
They would patch all the clusters, before the CVE went out.
Right.
Yeah. And I thought that was like fantastic in terms of just showing the benefits of using a managed service rather than unmanaged service when it came to Kubernetes. However, I would also want to call out as well, ACS Engine, a part of the configurations by default also mitigated one of the big risks when it came to allowing anonymous authorization. So using tools even when you have a lot more power and can customize it more greatly, it's still secure by default in such ways that also provides benefits, because really all AKS is being a lot of it's being built on ACS Engine. So having that security caked in at the bottom layer, open source, is very much preferable than bootstrapping your own cluster by spinning up a bunch of VMs and installing the certificates yourself. Mm-hmm. Having that expertise set those default configurations.
And in the same vein, I've got one partner that said, kubediff, that just came out in 1.13. We want to start running our production workloads on that.
What is kubediff?
That was, maybe you can give it a better way, but it's basically a way of, if you run diff in a file, it'll show you the difference between that is line by line.
Oh, so you can point to two clusters and say,
hey, this is what's installed, and this is what I'm going to install, and you can see the diff and see, that's actually what I'm going to do. And they're like, great, I want that, and I want that on my production cluster. I want 1.13. okay, great, have at it. And so then they definitely would not want managed clusters, not for them, because they really are interested in being the bleeding edge.
So where is all this land our support story like for AKS? Okay, I see. I get a little worried when you start figuring like
because that. That is a very good question.
So what are you seeing? Maybe Lucky can also say what they're thinking about from the product side, but what are you seeing from customers in terms of supportability of AKS? What kind of are there questions? Is it meeting the supporting needs that customers want?
So from a support perspective, I've had very little request for support issues, but more what's the roadmap? Because they are every week. I'm like, what's the next? When's this feature going to be out? When's this feature when is Windows Containers going to be up? Multiple agent pools. When are those going to be coming out? So that's been most of the support, you said, but more of the future thinking and less about
the operational
support.
Yeah, I know, Daniel, you guys have had your fair share of production kind of things that work out and whatnot. What has been your experience with the support structure that Microsoft has offered?
Yeah, so when it comes to AKS, it's without a doubt first class, given that it's a managed service and you want to mitigate any sort of problems that come up. And that's how oftentimes things get fixed as well, understanding what use cases came up and what problems they faced. From an unmanaged support as well, though, the community is incredibly responsive. So ACS Engine is our tool used to deploy unmanaged Kubernetes. And it is the maintainers of it do an incredible job of having an open forum to not only be able to post and get resolutions to your problems, but even from a CERT perspective, just troubleshooting as well, lending some expertise from the product side or just the community as a whole when it comes to ACS Engine. And so from both an educational perspective and an understanding of where certain blockers are or where I can personally get better at troubleshooting, there is really good support, and it's one of the more active communities I've seen when it came to GitHub.
Okay.
Personally.
So what I'm hearing is that it's partly community supported, but lucky as customers are, when they are going to put something into production, they want to know we're 100% behind it, mm-hmm. not necessarily from a community perspective, but from a support perspective. So what is our future roadmap there?
We take support really seriously with along the line of all the Azure services, right? So when something goes GA, we have certain criteria for that service. But I think there's twofold support kind of falls for Kubernetes in twofold. One is using Kubernetes. So we certainly have still plenty of folks in the community and customers that are learning Kubernetes. They may not, be learning about different types of resources, how to use them, when to use them. So there's that level, which, I think the community has potentially to newcomers, there's a large barrier to entry, right? With the tooling and with expectations about how the service actually works. So, there is a learning curve. And then, core infrastructure wise, right? So it's a large gamut that we're trying to bridge here, but we feel that with a managed service where we control the control plane components, we can actually offer a better user story, so we can make sure that things are monitored in the state they need to be, scaled up when they need to be, scaled down. So, we're working towards having an outstanding platform and place to run Kubernetes. Obviously, putting your workloads on Kubernetes, your production workloads, companies need those kind of assurances to say, what are you going to do when things go bad? And they will eventually, one day, sadly, everything will have a problem. So it's giving folks, a warm feeling when they come on and use Kubernetes. But the rate of change is still high in the community as well. So things come and go and things change. So some of their support issues is like, hey, what happened to that API? Or what happened to this thing? Where is it going? So us keeping up with it with upstream also means that as people are deploying on a Kubernetes at this rapid rate that, we're trying to manage their expectations to the rate of change as well. So I think it's a really important thing for us, and we're putting a lot of energy into making the support organization great, from having trained staffing to make sure that people understand more about Kubernetes, the folks that support it, and having deeper technical knowledge so that, common things that trick all of us can be troubleshot really simply. But I would also want to point folks at the docs.azure.com. So we put a lot of time into not only technical documentation, but kind of when would you want to do this and why would you want to do this? What is the best practice? How would you achieve these results? So I would ask for listeners, if they're interested, also to look at the docs as well and ping us if you think there are gaps. One of the great things about our docs is you go to the bottom and you say, I want to raise an issue. It goes to GitHub. And if I wrote the doc, I get the email and somebody's on me making sure that I update the doc. So I think it's a great way to actually be involved and give Azure that feedback that this doc matters and it's not accurate. So can you please make it accurate? We want to make sure that that's...
Okay, that's funny because I actually just wrote a doc which went up for the BCDR, Business Continuity and Disaster Recovery for AKS.
Yep.
And now I know I'm going to get some emails. So, hey, all right.
yeah. But I like that there's that feedback loop.
Yeah. Yes.
I've seen plenty of doc sets that, because things are changing really quickly. So we're trying to keep up with the rate of change. And best practices also happen to change over time as more security comes online.
Sure.
So we have more frameworks to grasp. But, I would ask folks to go and take a look. And if you see things, they do actually come back and we are listening and we do care. So we're very interested in making sure that we have rock solid docs so people can come in and get started with things like Kubernetes.
Okay, so I feel as if I must clarify my laugh from earlier, which was about support. And one of the things that I do see in support, sometimes it is an operational support issue, is, hey, I'm running this pod and it's a JVM and it keeps dying. What's wrong? Why? Blah, blah, blah.
Yes,
and they go up the anger chain and go up to try to reach up and they talk to us and then we try to talk to the product team. But because Kubernetes is so still really new as far as the internet world, it's difficult sometimes to figure out, is this truly a managed Kubernetes issue? Is this a Kubernetes issue? Or did you forget to place a limit or on your JVM, on your pod, which will starve the rest of your other JVMs. Everyone's nodding and smiling and crying in the inside, but that is something. And it's where do you find that line? And that's we try to be sometimes that frontline support for them to help say, hey, look, here's how you architect your cluster. Here's some gotchas.
Right.
But that is the one line that I was laughing at.
Okay. Yeah, education's a big thing. And we take things like what Tommy just described and, for example, resource requests and limits. So if you were to use Visual Studio Code and you were to use the Kubernetes extension, we actually have it so that if you turn that on and you're operating, it'll actually say, hey, by the way, you're missing
resource limits. I saw that. Those squiggly lines come up.
Yeah, we want to, Kubernetes is large in the surface area of things that you can configure.
Right.
But just saying, hey, here are some just really lightweight ways to nudge folks as they're going through their journey, just to give them a more manageable experience, or at least meet their expectations, right? So it's not obvious when you come into Kubernetes that resource requests and limits are a thing that determines cluster utilization and scheduling, but they are. So subtle nudges are good, and I think the community as a whole needs to educate on how to onboard and make sure that things like this are deployed as safety first.
Right.
Come with a safety switch. So let's assume that everybody's going to inadvertently, not by choice, do the wrong thing, and help them do the right thing, so that they have a tripwire or a safety net at the end of the day, because it's not clearly not their intention.
Yeah.
But that's not being expressed in the service, so we need to make sure that as AKS. That we can give folks either docs or tooling that can help them nudge them in the directions of things they might want to look at that could cause them grief down the way.
Yeah, because there's what you know, then there's what you don't know. And then there's what you don't know, which
is
growing faster.
Yeah. You're right.
Definitely greater than what you don't know. It's also growing exponentially faster.
Yeah.
And part
of it is because Kubernetes is so easy. I got into it very easily compared to other container orchestrators. And it's just, just throw the containers there. But, it's just taking everything I give it, and it's running so beautifully. And then, next thing you're in trouble.
Right. You can end up with a false sense of security.
Right.
Yeah.
And understanding your failure modes and understanding how you recover is really critical to prolonged use.
And I think, in general, when it comes to Kubernetes, what helps and attracts a lot of people is that when you're first working on it, it seems it just works. But taking into the education when people are adopting the technology is that is introducing them to situations maybe where it won't work or where you can do something wrong, and then educating them on how to resolve
induce
and recognize
failure
that.
And yeah, see, exactly. This is what happens. Yeah. Yep.
Because it all works until it doesn't.
Yep. Well, thank you guys very much. It's so fortunate that we could have all of you here today at KubeCon, and appreciate all your comments. If you have any links, I know, like you said, you have some links. You guys have any favorite links you want to share with me? Send me. I'll put them up in the podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.